Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back. I had the pleasure of having another conversation with Keith Broders. One of the things I recognize in talking with Keith over the past, I want to say I've known Keith for about 4 or 5 years and over the phone. We've never met. And this, interestingly enough, there was a point in time where we lived minutes away from each other and our paths never crossed. And that was more due to the fact that when I was in the intelligence community, I lived a very sterile life. I didn't get involved with a lot of other people. I mean, I was working too much, and I just didn't have that bandwidth to nurture and develop friends outside of work and church and so forth. And so anyway, it wasn't until like 2014 when I actually met Doug Gibbs, and at that point in time, he never introduced me to Keith, but Keith had been living pretty close by in a neighboring town. But anyway, I don't want to reminisce too much here, but the point is, I getting to know Keith, and I've had conversations where I don't necessarily are disagreeing or trying to argue, and there's those debates that are discourse that kind of come up dynamically as people are talking. And this is kind of interesting because, you know, I always say reasonable people equally informed seldom disagree. The people that are, you know, equally informed, but they have, you know, each of us have these outliers. And so we're not, when we look at how equally informed we are, we're not necessarily that equally informed. Anyway, I'll just say this. I think Keith is a better man than I, because I'm not sure if I offend him or something or what have you, but he's never said anything other, you know, to me in an argument. He's always been a gentleman. And so in this conversation, we went in without any prep. We just wanted to talk about the topics, because that's what I like to do. And I like to talk dynamically because I don't necessarily want to prepare him for, you know, for the most part. And I've said this before, I don't like having conversations to where when we finally actually have the interview that we record, I forget, or I think that I've already asked that, we've already had that conversation, and it's hard for me to associate, you know, especially when the conversations go on for an hour or so, and you're thinking 10, 20 minutes, yeah, we already talked about that, so I won't bring that up, when come to find out, that was in a previous conversation. So I've really tried to curtail any previous conversations, but Keith has never been one that has ever, I mean, it's not that he's, that hasn't taken a different stand or position. And I just have to say he's a better man than me, because if I got offended, if I ever, you know, got into a discourse with people, I mean, I will, I guess it's that Marine mentality in me. I just go toe to toe to toe to toe to toe. And if I understand exactly what I'm talking about and I have the data and the facts, then I will continue going toe-to-toe. Now, if somebody is coming up with different information that I've never heard before or a different view of something, then I would, you know, I'd take a pause and say, you know, I've never thought of it that way. Let me look at this and let me ponder on this and I'll get back to you. But as you know, this show is also sponsored by RepublicReview.org, and you are listening to the only show that goes through academic evidence and academic evidence-based solutions. In this interview with Keith, and it's going to span over today's show and tomorrow's show, in this interview with Keith, we're going to cover some stuff that you've probably never heard, and you know, like the Corbin Amendment. I've never even brought this up. I just want you to understand that there's just so much history that when I start engaging with people, when I start helping people get to the platform of what they really need to understand so that they can start killing dragons, you don't have to have this much history. You don't have to have this kind of profound knowledge. All you need to know is why things are the way they are. It's a compact. The states of the parties, those fundamental basics, then nobody can shake your conviction, your testimony, your paradigm. It can't shift. It can broaden, but it can't shift. Once you have a firm footing on the truth and the facts of what the problem really is and what we have to do. So, because a lot of people, they... They say, I want to have that level. I want to be there. I want to have that knowledge. And, you know, the fact is that takes a lot of time. And people don't necessarily need to spend that kind of time, if you understand what I'm saying. If you really want to, then you will. And then I'm not the one holding you back. If you want to know what to read, if you go to the MobiStripPress.com page, I actually have recommended reading. And I would recommend reading all of those books, because those are the books I've read. And and I haven't even updated that in a long time. Not that I've been reading. You get to a point where you get, like, I don't want to say saturation, but you go, you know what? I'm not getting much more out of it. The only books that I get more out of are source documents that were written a long time ago, like Alexis de Tocqueville, Democracy in America, those types of books. What was that gentleman's name that wrote The Wealth of Nations? Adam Smith. Adam Smith's books. There's a couple of books I'd like to get of his that I just don't have at this point. So I've read Wealth of Nations. That's another awesome book. I highly recommend reading source books like that, where, you know, it is basically, you know, a spewing of data and information collected by an individual back in a time when their biases were nothing like ours today. So you're looking at it almost like through pure, you know, clear glass, no filtering or anything else. When we come back, we will have Keith. We'll go into a break after this interview, and then I'll come back for a few short words. Thank you so much. All right, folks, we've got Keith. Hey, Keith, how you doing today?
I'm doing great. Thank you very much, JR.
And so the last time we spoke, you wanted to talk about the South secession and the legitimacy. Could they actually secede? Is that not correct?
That is true. And I think the place we're going to have to start is we're going back to the Second Continental Congress that met to end up drafting the Declaration of Independence. And basically, there was nowhere in the British Constitution was there anything mentioned about the right of secession. And so when the Founding Fathers met in Philadelphia and declared their independence, they were basically on uncharted water, so to speak. They basically claimed that they had a God-given right to alter or abolish their government if the government became tyrannical. And as a result of the oppressive taxation and regulation by Parliament and the King, the Founding Fathers said, well, we believe that we have a God-given right to abandon this government and to start our own government from scratch. Well, there was nothing. They had to basically back up their declaration with a force of arms. They had to defend their position. And obviously, when the petition essentially, or the declaration, reached the King and the Parliament, they did not accept it. And this is exactly what happened later on in the case of the Civil War. Now, the main reason that the colonies wanted to secede, a lot of it had to do with the economic conditions, the fact that the British government had taken over the monetary system, and that we were being hit with oppressive taxation, etc. And it's very, very similar to what happened when the South seceded, because they were doing virtually the same thing. The fact of the matter is that our country was conceived by secession. We basically seceded, and basically the South, they followed the same pattern. They were basically being hit with tariffs. that were oppressive. The moral tariff brought the taxation up to a very high level, which caused a financial hardship on the South. At the beginning of the Civil War, the South had been paying, even though they only represented about less than a third of the population of the country, they were paying essentially 80% of the tax revenue was coming out of the South. And so, in fact, one of the things that was quoted to Horace Greeley apparently one time asked Abraham Lincoln, he says, well, why don't you just let the South go in peace? And he said, well, if we do that, who will pay the taxes? Who will pay for the government? And so the war, Civil War, more rightly should be called the War of Northern Aggression or the Second War of American Independence. We won the first war, but we lost the second one. In the Declaration of Independence, it clearly states that we proclaim that we have a right to alter or abolish our government when it becomes tyrannical. And that's exactly what they did. And so if the Southern states followed the pattern previously set in Philadelphia in the Convention of 1776, if the states had a right to secede, then why would they not have a right to secede now? The other factor that I'll mention is that in the 10th Amendment, it basically says that any power and or authority that is not granted specifically to the central government and not prohibited to the states is reserved to the states and to the people. And since the word secession does not come up in the Constitution, it becomes one of the reserved powers spoken of in the 10th Amendment. The 10th Amendment does not say that the states cannot, if the states are not prevented from doing something, they have the power to do anything they want as long as the Constitution is not prohibited.
Okay, so when you look at the Federalist Papers and when you look at the ratification debates, just to support this, the Constitution was clarified and it went to ad nauseum by the Federalists that this is a compact, that the parties to this compact are the states and the states alone. And so in Madison, I forget which Federalist paper it was, he points out that when one part of the compact is violated, it basically opens up the door for the whole compact to be thrown out by whatever parties, by all parties or by one particular party. So he was laying out the argument that, you know, if it comes to a point in time where, you know, the anti-federalists are correct, that they violate the Constitution and they start becoming oppressive, then those states that are being oppressed, because it's a violation of the Constitution, that's all they got to do is say, you're violating the compact and we're out of here. And so in basic compact law or contract law, you know, when the compact is being violated by one party or by an entity that is created by the parties, like the federal government, then if the federal government is violating the compact, those states, any state, it opens up the door for any state to secede. Now, I want to throw this in here because when we look at and this is really blindsiding you, but when we look at Republic Review and the states start moving to force the federal government into compliance, here's the question for you. When California sees that they're now going to be forced into doing things that they don't want to do because they don't want to give up their progressive things that they're doing, which is violating the compact itself. So here's the question. Can California secede from the union if the Constitution is being forced to be followed and the states have to follow it?
Well, I believe that California and Texas and any other state, basically, for any reason, the 10th Amendment to me basically gives them that prerogative.
Well, so
any power or authority that is not specifically denied to the states is reserved to the states.
Right, right.
So it's their choice.
But let's be clear. The whole point of secession is a point that the compact itself, because they've committed to coming into this compact. The question is, do you have a legal right when the compact is being violated? The Southern states had a legal right because the compact was being violated. However, when all of a sudden a state decides to violate the Constitution, do they have a right to secede?
Well, I think that in the case of California and the other states is concerned, I think that the central government or the national government, if you will, they have violated the contract or the compact in so many different places.
No, I get it. But if we look and if you understand Republic Review is where the majority of the states actually start forcing the federal government into compliance, which means that the federal government is going to turn off its spigot for abortions. It's going to turn off its spigot for the education system. All of these things that they're unconstitutionally funding goes away. Now, a progressive state like California could come along and say, hey, you know, we really needed that, and we're not going to stick around to this union if you're not going to continue violating the Constitution. If you're going to start abiding by it, then we're out of here. Now, so this is where it gets interesting. Does the Constitution create jurisdiction over citizens?
According to Article 1, Section 8, Clause 17, it's known as the Enclave Clause, and it basically indicates that the jurisdiction of the national government, the central government, does not extend beyond the boundaries of Washington, D.C. 10 miles square is the extent of the jurisdiction of the government of the United States.
Okay, so here's then with that, does the United States have jurisdiction on any U.S. citizen who's committed a crime of treason? Or is there such a thing as a U.S. citizen?
Well, this question of citizenship, it's interesting that we're starting to start moving a little bit toward the 14th Amendment.
I get that. I do get that. I want to focus on secession, though, because my point is if the states are oppressing these citizens, because they do have an obligation in protecting the privileges and immunities. Like if you go to Article 4 of the Constitution, is there not a privilege and immunities clause?
Yes, there is. And for example, Sheriff Mack used to talk a lot about this in his early talks about what he called dual sovereignty. And basically, the state governments have a responsibility to protect us from the abuse of power by the central government. But on the same token, the central government has a responsibility to protect the states against the abuse of power by their state governments. And that's basically there is a check going in both directions.
Right. So most people have a hard time getting their head wrapped around this concept that the United States Constitution actually did create citizenship of all citizens. I mean, everybody that lived within the states that was a resident of the state at the time the Constitution was formed, they were all kind of, you know, this big broad blanket went across everybody. It says you're now U.S. citizens. Then everybody that was born to a U.S. citizen, you know, had that birthright of a U.S. citizen. Does that make sense?
Okay.
And so when the federal government started identifying the citizens, if you go through, I mean, shoot, I just did a search real quick. There's 24 times citizen of the United, well, the citizen is brought up. It's been brought up in Article 1, Article 2, Article, and as a matter of fact, the voting has to be done by U.S. citizens. If you're going to vote in a federal election, you have to be a U.S. citizen. And so even though they hardly have any laws, there are a few laws that the federal government in Article 1, Section 8 actually created this protection of U.S. citizens. First, the two crimes that they can actually prosecute a U.S. citizen would be over treason or counterfeiting, correct?
Yes.
They had jurisdiction over those two crimes and only those two crimes. And then they also had jurisdiction over crimes that U.S. citizens could be arrested on the high seas or over in foreign land. And the U.S. government extended its jurisdiction over citizens abroad, basically claiming jurisdiction over any crime committed on the high seas by a U.S. citizen or a crime against the laws of nations by a U.S. citizen.
Was George Washington and Thomas Jefferson, Madison, were they citizens of the United States or were they citizens of Virginia?
Well, they were both. When the United States was created, it actually just created this you know, abracadabra, this magical citizenship of the Union, because all citizens of the states were also granted this protection. Because does the federal court have appellate and jurisdiction over issues between one citizen and a different state that they lived in? So in other words, if a different state was saying, hey, you know, you did this bad deed, or the state did a bad deed and took property away from somebody that wasn't a resident of that state, then they had a right to go to the federal government to say, hey, look, you know, these people stole my property. This state has stolen my property, right? I mean, there is this level of jurisdiction, even though it was really, I'll just call it innocuous. It just didn't seem that obvious to most people, because the federal government didn't have hardly any impact in the day-to-day lives of most all U.S. citizens.
That's correct.
But the Privileges and Immunities Clause in Article 4 clearly identifies that the common privileges and immunities protected by this Constitution, and that means the same thing of your right of a trial by jury and all of these other things based on the Bill of Rights that was passed right after that, or even before. When we look at the U.S. Constitution, most people think that it did not create U.S. citizens, but that's the biggest lie or deceit, because it even mentions U.S. citizens. Anybody that voted in the elections for their electors, for their representatives, they had to be a U.S. citizen.
Well, there's the citizens of the United States, but there's also citizens of the United States Corporation.
Well, so there's no constitutional standing. We can get into that. There's no constitutional standing for a U.S. United States corporation of government to be created. There's nowhere in the Constitution where the federal government was delegated the authority by the states to be able to create their own protective corporation. To do that, it would have required an amendment to the Constitution. Do you not agree?
I agree.
Okay, so in other words, here was the beginning of this huge facade that the federal government created, and they actually started, you know, violating the Constitution in many ways. And with some of those ways was by paying, because this is why when we get into the 14th Amendment, we'll see in Section 4 that the United States government was prohibited in paying any debt that was occurred by the Civil War of the Southern states. Now, back to this whole thing of secession. My contention is that if you're a state and the United States government, the federal government, the general government is waging a hostile war against you, such as the terrible the terrible tariffs of the 1830s, right? The terrible tariffs?
The tariff of abomination.
Tariffs of abomination. Thank you. That was a John C. Calhoun adjective. But and just so my listeners understand this. But my point is that the states had a right to protect themselves and protect their citizens from this hostile action by the federal government. And right now, every state in the union could actually, that looks at what the federal government is doing in such perverse ways of exercising unconstitutional authority from the Department of Transportation, Department of Energy, Department of Education, Health and Human Service, all of these different things that they're waging this, you know, socialistic warfare that they have no power to do, then every state could secede and we could actually see this Constitution gone. It would literally be torn up. And so this is why my appeal to the states is you owe it to all of us to force the federal government into fixing and abiding by this. So back to California. If California all of a sudden sees that the federal government is now going to be forced into turning off its unconstitutional spending of money and so forth, does California have a right to take these U.S. citizens and move them into a communist state? Or does the federal government and the states of the union have an obligation in protecting those citizens?
Well, you're right. You did kind of blindside me. I'm really going to have to ponder that a little bit rather than making a snap.
Right. I thank you. But I didn't mean to blindside you. But my point is that even though states can secede, it's a legal standing that they can secede. Anytime the federal government is violated, so technically every state in the union right now could secede from the union because the federal government has no authority to wage Obamacare, has no authority to wage mandates of vaccinations. All of this tyranny that is coming from Washington, D.C. are strict violations of the Constitution. Do you not agree?
I agree.
And so it gives...
Another issue is this whole idea of general welfare. I think it's pretty clear the Constitution tells us how the government can spend money. They can spend it to pay their debts. They can spend it on providing for the common defense and the general welfare. Well, they're spending money on a lot of things that are certainly not general welfare. They're specific welfare that are designed to benefit certain individuals and certain special interest groups.
Well, so that clause you're talking about in the and folks, what Keith is talking about is the preamble to Section 8 of Article 1. And that preamble basically says this: the Congress shall have the power to lay and collect taxes, duties, imposts, and excises to pay the debts and provide for the common defense and general welfare of the United States. But all duties, imposts, and excises shall be uniform throughout the United States. That there is a preamble, and this is how it was explained legally in the ratification debates, that they were creating a generalized paradigm, or they were laying out the reason why they were granting the following powers: that to borrow money, to regulate commerce, to establish uniform, all of these powers that they were going to lay out was for the purpose to provide for the common defense and general welfare. And it was very well stipulated. As a matter of fact, Governor Randolph in the Virginia ratification debates came right out and said that clause, that preamble, does not grant any general powers.
And the question that I have right now is that using this idea of providing for the common defense, isn't that what the COVID is all about, trying to provide for the common defense?
Well, so when it comes down to providing for the common defense, then this is what they have the authority to do. They have the authority to call forth the militia to execute the laws of the union, only those laws in pursuant to these enumerated powers. So when it comes down to biological warfare, have the states formally amended the Constitution to say, hey, if there's a pandemic, if there's an epidemic of virus that hits us, then you have the authority to do whatever you need to do. There's no amendment like that, Keith. So my point is they can't just presume. This is where I provide people the basics of the Department of Transportation and how the three presidents vetoed three times Congress's attempt to create the footings for a Department of Transportation, because clearly, I mean, it talks about post roads. It talks about, the connections between the states and so forth. I mean, the power to regulate commerce. There were like five or six different implied powers that Congress came right out and said, look, we believe that we have the right to do this. Madison, Monroe, and Andrew Jackson, all three of these presidents said those powers do not exist within what you're implying, that the only way the federal government can actually start improving highways and waterways between the states is to amend the Constitution. So if they couldn't do it for just a highway system and waterway system, There's no way they could do it for a medical system, because medical was definitely not at all mentioned or delegated to the federal government.
Okay,
so back to your point, because I know what you wanted to talk about. The secession by the southern states and the tariffs of abomination, the states were literally in this point, and as you aptly have pointed out several times, as a matter of fact, how Lincoln really basically said, who's going to pay for the federal government if we lose these southern states? We need that revenue. Well, that revenue was unconstitutional, so they needed to figure out some other way of doing this. Right? I mean, but bottom line, you're absolutely correct. The southern states had several different, I would say, supporting factors. They had the compact law, the fundamental compact law, because they were violating the compact. That gave them the opportunity. The fundamental inalienable rights of being able to change or alter or put off any government was another factor that you've brought up. And so absolutely, when federal government becomes tyrannical and it starts asserting arbitrary powers or asserting powers it doesn't possess, then we absolutely, or I should say the states absolutely have a constitutional standing to secede. And actually, I would even say this, they have an obligation to secede from the Union, or is there another option?
Well, the one thing that is really clear in my mind is the fact that in order to save the Union, Lincoln had to trash the Constitution, because basically slavery was a lawful institution when the Constitution was ratified. And in order to change that, the Constitution needed to be amended. Well, there's no way in the world that with the 34 states that existed in the Union at that time, you weren't going to get two-thirds of the states. Two-thirds of the representatives of the states in the state, in the U.S. Senate and in the House of Representatives to actually propose an amendment that would abolish slavery. So
right.
They could not abolish slavery legally without going through the amendment process.
So
he had to do the alternative. In other words, he had to go ahead and scrap the Constitution in order to save the Union.
So I'll submit this. And I'm not trying to blindside you, but I think we might have discussed this. And looking at the macro view of the Constitution, the framers didn't know. I think maybe a couple of them kind of calculated that this actually, you know, the Constitution was made in such a way that slavery would come to the forefront, and it would be pressured into it basically being annihilated in the United States. Now, I say that because this was predating Eli Whitney's, you know, abomination of the cotton gin, right? Because once the cotton gin was invented in the late 1790s, then all of a sudden, you know, it seemed like, wow, you know, America now had this real need for, you know, hard labor, or I should say that slave labor that the cotton gin helped sustain. Does that make sense?
Yeah. You know, one other thought here too, GR, and that is,
sure,
is that if we could go back in time, Georgia and frankly, South Carolina were the only two states that would have been unwilling to abolish slavery. They were so adamantly opposed to it because they had a large number of slaves, particularly South Carolina. But basically, in the Declaration of Independence, the language that Thomas Jefferson had written in there about the slave trade,
right?
The Rutledge from South Carolina said, "Look, if you leave those clauses in the Declaration of Independence, we will not sign this Declaration of Independence. And this Declaration of Independence requires unanimous support of all the states. So we are going to completely shit can your Declaration of Independence unless you scrap the clause on the importation of slaves."
Right.
I frankly believe what should have happened is the other states, the 11 states that would have gone for abolition of slavery, should have gone ahead and done it and said, "Okay, Georgia, you and South Carolina can go off on your own and form your little two-state coalition, and basically we will essentially force you into coming on board with us down the road.
Well, so technically, North Carolina was, at the Constitutional Convention, it was both both Carolinas as well as Georgia that said, if you make slavery unconstitutional, then we can no longer be a part of the Union because we're too dependent on slave labor. And so this is where I wanted to go with this, because in the macro view, most people thought that, you know, the Constitution was protecting slavery. However, mathematically, what was going to happen, because the slaves, for those who were able to vote, because we had this conversation before that the listeners have not been privy to, but the people that voted, I mean, I don't think you brought it up. You may have brought it up about the Electoral College, that there were very few people. How many people voted in the first presidential election?
25,000 people voted for George Washington. He got all 69 electoral votes, but only 25,000 popular votes were counted.
Okay, 25,000 popular votes across all of the states, but that wasn't for George Washington. That was for the electors supporting George Washington.
Correct.
Okay, so there were millions of people, folks, in the United States at the time. So
3.9 million.
Right, almost four. And so here, this is my point. At that point in time, the people that had representation the voting, I should say, that had slavery, they were only able to count their 3/5. Now, when you look at the 3/5 rule and then this 1808 clause that shut down the slave trade. Now, the reason why the slave trade was left or put into the Constitution was to reinvigorate or to restock slaves in the United States, because the states lost slaves from the Revolutionary War, right? Okay. And so that's why they said, we have to have this because, you know, we have to replenish all of those, all of the slaves that we lost. How did they lose the slaves?
Well, some of them were killed, obviously. And I think some of them essentially who had got joined with the British because they were told that they would be given their emancipation if they were support the cause of the British government.
There was that. And then how many states offered freedom if they would fight to support the United States?
I don't know.
There were actually a few states that were offering freedom. So some of those states, because they were so heavily populated with slaves, some of those states just basically turned right around and says, if you will protect us, we will grant you your freedom. And that was a big contributor to why they lost so many slaves. And so they had to basically replenish this vacancy that they created because of the war. So my point is that they agreed and made the concession that they were going to allow the states to control the importation of persons. In other words, the immigration process for the first 20 years of the United States was maintained and managed by the states. In 1808, the magical day, that is when the federal government took over the importation of all persons. This is when the slave states were shut down, or I should say the slave trade, the transportation of slaves. And so one would think that they had brought in enough that they would not need to, you know, do anything more for them to, you know, just be happy and exist. So let me ask you this question. Why is it that they broke the Constitution when they allowed the Missouri Compromise to be passed in Congress? In 1820, the Missouri Compromise was presented as a deal which would then force slavery upon all states south of a latitude of the United States. I forget what it is, 39th parallel, whatever it is. Right?
I'm not really prepared to.
Oh, okay. So my point is that in 1820, the Missouri Compromise, because the South started recognizing that they weren't growing, they need, and as a matter of fact, Missouri was coming into the states, coming into the United States, the majority of the people didn't want slavery. And so they realized that they didn't want to put it to a vote of the people. What they needed was they needed the federal government to basically mandate slavery upon all of these new southern states so that they could maintain a balance, because they saw as the states were going to grow and proliferate, if those states weren't slave states, then it would eventually come to a point where all of the slave, all of the non-slave states would overnumber or outnumber the slave states and create an amendment to basically abolish slavery.
Correct.
Anyway, I'm sorry. But all of these things are really, they've dovetailed. And they're all kind of a part of this, because back to the reason why the South seceded, right? The reason why was economic warfare.
Isn't it just the same as the Revolutionary War?
Well, was it? Yeah, so there were, I think that was, there were a lot of factors, but that was the catalyst, because it was the taxes. I think that's when they called them the terrible taxes, right?
Yeah, it was the tariff of abomination.
Was it tariffs of abomination in the 1770s?
No. I'm sorry. That was in the Civil War era.
Right. I think it was the terrible tariffs. It was the Stamp Act and a couple of the other
Intolerable Acts.
Right, the Intolerable Acts. That's right. Thank you so much. I'm terrible with names. But back to your point, the secession was really driven by this fact of the South having to pay an unfair amount of taxes, when the Constitution clearly stated that there were to be taxes that would be uniform across the states, correct?
That's also true. I hadn't thought about that, but that's exactly right.
Right. And so the federal government started actually, they figured out how to make slaves out of the southern states. Right? Because that's what they were doing. They were the ones that had to toil for the benefits of all of the rest of the Union when the South was paying more than its fair share. So going through it, and I know you haven't read these, but I would recommend, and if you can find four of the documents on the Avalon Project, the Confederate papers, it's in the 19th century, page in the Avalon Project. It actually has four of the southern states. It has Texas, South Carolina, Georgia, and I forget the other one. But if you go through there, they clearly identify slavery as the key factor, because they were being punished by the rest of the Union because they had slave labor. I mean, so they weren't necessarily ignorant towards, what was going on. And so at this point in time, as we kind of look at the Civil War, and it was really coming to be because the South was seceding because of economic reasons, but they pointed to the cause of the economic reasons in these secession papers, because they were, is this hostility towards their slave trade, their management of labor in these states. Now, with that, we really ran out of time because it took a long time. But what I'd like to do in our next follow-up, if you can hold on with me, well, I'll just wrap this up and we'll pick this up for the next session, for my next episode. I'd like to talk about the Corbin Act, or the Corbin Amendment, as well as, because the Corbin Amendment would have been the 13th Amendment. That's going to kind of open the door for all three 13 Amendments, right? So,
correct.
Keith, if you can hold on a sec, we'll let me take a break, and I will close out this show with my listeners, and we will be able to start up a whole new conversation regarding this whole secession and actually Lincoln's compromise, this Corbin Amendment. So, folks, with that, I appreciate your patience, Keith. Folks, with that, we'll be right back after this one promo. So please stay tuned, and then we'll have Keith on in our next show, and you're going to hear us conversing regarding the three 13th Amendments, two of which you probably never knew nothing about. So thank you so much, Keith. Folks, we'll be right back after this. To set the record straight, Republic Review is neither an Article 5 convention nor a convention of states. In accordance with Article 5 of the Constitution, this convention requires two-thirds of the states to apply to Congress to convene a convention with the intent to amend the Constitution. This convention is unable to solve our real problem, which is non-compliance to the Constitution, and would be dangerous to convene at this time. In contrast, Republic Review is the process of the states exerting its constitutional authority over the Constitution. An audit does not require an application to Congress. This authority is inherent to principal stakeholders of a contract. Why do we need Republic Review? Because this is the only way the states can deal with the federal encroachments into roles, responsibilities, and powers that belong to the states. To learn more about Republic Review, please go to reclaimingtherepublic.org to read my content and my model on the audit and Republic Review process. Okay, if you want to join in on the dialogue, you need to call 215-TOP-TALK. That's 215-867-8255.
Okay, so as you can see, Keith is a bevy of knowledge. And he, like I said, here's a person that I've crossed paths with that's much like myself. He is one of those people that is trying to make an impact. I mean, it's not like Keith is trying to line. I've never seen Keith, you know, try to line his pockets with gold. Now, if you want to help somebody, help Keith. If you go to the constitutioneducation.us, you will find there's probably a donation link right there. You can send him some money, because what he is doing is and we still haven't done this yet. We need to have this conversation, because he has this. It's like a social media page with Ning.com that he created, basically a social media where when you log in or when you create your account, you have to provide personal information. And the information you provide is like your state, your county, city you live in. I don't know. I don't think you have to put in your mailing address to that level. But what it does is it registers you to a very specific county, and in so doing, it then links you and it helps you identify all those people that are in that county. Now, if you're a person that does not want to have autonomy or wants to have autonomy and does not want to have visibility to a lot of people, like you know, want to lurk around in the shadows, this wouldn't be your type of page. But if you're looking to connect with like-minded constitutionalists, because this is going to be used, at least this is what we want to talk about, this is how the Constitution Party is going to start creating an interface for constitutionalists to come and use this for them. Now, what I believe is he's created a gem. I believe he has something that no other organization will have, where you can actually start opening it up and letting people, you know, come in. Now, there's many things, because I've talked to the Constitution Party about what they need to do on top of this, but you really have to have somebody before you just let somebody join, because somebody can, you know, come in and log in and create an account. But before you actually, you know, approve that account, you really have to do some vetting, because we do know that there are people out there
that will try to come in to, one, infiltrate and to, you know, to disrupt and do bad things. If you understand how evil can be, there's nothing stopping it from trying to do those things. This is why there may be, one of the vetting processes may be, what I would call references. You have to actually have to have a few people reference you that are already in the group that are well established. And in so doing, then you kind of help, okay, this person is semi good to go. And then somebody could be easily revoked because of, one, either behavior, or two, come to find out that person really wasn't who they said they were. But more importantly, I've told the Republican, the Constitution Party, I've told a lot of different organizations that they need to get this account with LexisNexis so that they have a subscription, so that they can constantly vet people that are coming in, so that they can say, based on this criminal record and everything else, you need to reach out and talk to this person as to why they're trying to join us, because they may not be, I'm going to use these quotes, air quotes here, one of us. But what Keith has is he has a tool that will allow people to start getting organized in a social media sense. Unlike anything, this isn't just a page. This is something that identifies, you and all of your fellow county and those people in your state, and you can even start drilling into other counties and so forth. But that would require a little bit of administration on the state side. So what we're looking at is we're really trying to, and actually Keith is he's the brainchild here. Keith has the ability to, provide these types of tools. And so I can't tell you enough how much of a patriot, what he's doing, and he needs help and support. So if you go to constitutioneducation.us, please go, and you will find, you'll probably find a link to a contribution. Send them some love, send them some money. I truly enjoy our conversations. And one of the things that we still need to get into, besides just, this tool, besides the Constitution, education, and so forth, what we want to do, what I'd like to do, is I'd like to actually go through these different campaign issues and so forth, because Keith's all about solutions. That's one of the things that I think helped us kind of link and sync, because it was really trying to strike at the root of what the problem is, because Keith was the one that first cited that David Thoreau, thousands strike at the branch of evil, but, one always strikes at the root, or one is striking at the root. And so he is a guy that's looking to strike at the root. And this is one of the reasons why I think we've synced and we are working together. I'm G.R. Mobley. We'll have Keith back tomorrow. We're reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
I've been on the radio for a couple of years, and for over a decade, I have been providing content to help patriots understand what has to be done if we're going to save our Constitution and our Republic. Not one academic has been able to refute my argument for Republic Review, and even most conservative entertainers will not support Republic Review due to self-interest reasons. If you have not read my bullet point descriptions and executive summaries, you need to, so that you can understand what we all need to do. I am trying to give patriots the necessary knowledge to take back our Constitution and Republic. Go to reclaimingtherepublic.org so you can read my bullet points and view the Republic Review flowchart. You can even order my executive summaries, books, and other content to understand the simplicity of what we have to do. This way, you will know what, why, and how to support the reclaiming of our Republic. Again, please take a look at my content on reclaimingtherepublic.org so you can become a part of the solution.